Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In downtown Homer and on the web at wodabotanicals.com. Hello and welcome to Homer Grown. This is a show about gardening, agriculture, and wild habitat. My name is Desiree Hagen, and I live on a micro farm in Fritz Creek, Alaska. For this episode, we talked to two farmers, Gene MacArthur, who has provided starts to the wagon wheel for over four decades, and Al Poindexter, who is the owner of the Anchor Point Greenhouse and also the maker of Fishy Pete and Alaska Earth Potting Soil. We're going to hear from Al first. Could you introduce yourself?
I thought you already knew who I was. I don't know how to introduce myself. My name is Al Poindexter, and I happen to be the owner of Anchor Point Greenhouse.
But you also produce two potting soils, Alaska Earth and Fishy Pete.
Well, we mix ingredients together to make potting soil, yeah. Where are we going first? You want to see the dirt first? Or I can take you on a complete tour. Your choice.
What do you think?
Well, this is the store. We're also starting to mess with some house plants. They're not too successful yet, but we're trying to mess with that. Plus, we have all the irrigation materials for people and little garden tools, that kind of stuff, pots. This is our vegetable house, vegetable and herbs, just mostly herbs right now, a few cucumbers and tomatoes, and eventually we'll be filling this up with cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, all the starts that anybody would want for gardens. So that's that one. That's that.
So how long have you been running this greenhouse?
I started helping my parents in 1994. My brothers and I built the first greenhouse in 1976. So this makes the 46th year been in operation.
Are you born and raised Alaskan?
I was born in Seward.
How old are you?
I'm 74. Is that a bad thing or a good thing?
It's neither. It's the honest truth.
I grew up in a little log cabin right where these birds are right now. And then it finally rotted away and started falling in on my mother. So we built this little gray house for my mom. And we've turned that into an office.
So peacocks.
Yeah. Peacocks originate in India, but they're pretty hardy because they stay in this big greenhouse all winter long without any heat or anything, and they do pretty well. Those are my pet chickens.
And then what, some ducks?
Ducks. One of the farmers died a while back, and he had ducks, and they didn't know what to do with them, so I ended up with them. My wife ended up with them. And guess who has to feed them? That's our major grower. This is KBBI.
Hi.
He's the guy that makes all these tomatoes and cucumbers grow. This three-bay greenhouse will produce up to about 30,000 pounds of tomatoes in a season. And then those plants along the side there and down at the end are grapes, and those are blueberries, but mostly it's all tomatoes. So yeah, these are all getting tied up now, and we have a pretty neat system. So as a tomato climbs a string, when it gets high enough, then we just release a strand of string and let the stem lay on the ground so that you can continually reach the tomatoes and the blooms as it goes up. So eventually we'll have another 10 feet of stem on the ground by the end of the season.
So three bay. So how big do you know the footage?
It's almost 7,000 square feet in here. I have a standby generator here, so if the power ever goes out, these furnaces won't go out. Because if we lose power for more than a couple of hours, especially at night, I could lose the whole crop.
How are they heated?
Natural gas.
And so I see that there's several greenhouses.
My natural gas bill was $7,000 this last.
$7,000 a month?
Yep, for a month. So I have to grow a lot. These are cucumbers. The ground was a little bit wet and a little bit cold when we put these out. That's the reason why they have yellow leaves, but the tops are starting to green up now. So they'll be in pretty good shape here. Actually, we probably have cucumbers by the end of the week.
I mean, I see some of them already.
Yeah, we'll probably have some that we'll pick at the end of the week.
I mean, that's pretty impressive for...
This early?
This early, right?
Yeah.
April 25th.
Yeah, I'd say by mid-May we'll be producing probably 50 pounds a week.
Is that normally how early they come?
Yeah, they're pretty fast. I know you want to get to the dirt. I don't know how much more you want to see. There's nothing growing down there at all yet. This is peonies, and then there's peonies on the back side of those greenhouses, and farther back is berries and another field for vegetables. That one Connex is used as a dehydrator for rhodiola. Upstairs is kind of storage, and the other Connex is storage. Underneath that excavator is a 720 square foot root cellar. It's kind of dirty right now.
You know, it really looks like you're making good use of the space. How much acreage is this complex?
Well, we have a total of 10 acres. All of the ground, all the way to Fritz Road, is all farm.
This is the root cellar built into this mound.
Yes.
It's like we're going into a little cave.
Into a side of a hill.
Oh my gosh, I love it. Should I close the door?
No, leave it open. It's not. I built it primarily for veggies and potatoes. But then we started growing peonies, and peonies need to be right at about 33 degrees. And the natural temperature stays in here at 38 degrees. So it's too warm for peonies. So then I installed this refrigeration system, and I only turn it on when I have peonies. Smells kind of garbage in here because I left some cabbage in here, and they got a lot of mold on them toward the end of the season. Cabbage lasts me pretty good until Christmas, and then they start deteriorating, and then I got lazy and left a bunch of them in here and created kind of a smell. But since we're here, I'll let you look at the dehydrator. I have a refrigerated trailer over there so I can refrigerate stuff and then move it down the road. And then on the other side is a rotating drum that I wash rhodiola in.
So this is the dehydrator inside this Connex?
Yeah, this is a dehydrator.
Whoa.
Usually we got a lot more shelving in here, but we fill up these racks plumb full of rhodiola. I can dry about a ton of rhodiola in 24 hours in here. It dehydrates it right down to about 5%
moisture. A ton? So I'm trying to remember my middle school math.
2,000 pounds.
2,000 pounds.
Yeah.
Of rhodiola in a day.
In a 24-hour period, yep.
Is that how much you pull in a day during the height of the season?
Oh, you know, it comes in batches. Different farmers will bring their batches in. Each batch takes a day or two to wash and slice. I have a slicer in here. We slice them up and then put them on those racks and then dry it. And one guy brought in a semi-load. It took him almost a month to get them washed, sliced, and dried. And that was quite a bit.
How many farmers use this dehydrator?
Kind of depends. They don't always harvest every year. There's about 12 farmers in the state now that are farming rhodiola. Some of them only have like a tenth of an acre, and some of them have 5 to 6 acres of rhodiola. All depends.
How many are in our area?
3 in the Homer Anchor Point area, 1 in Nikiski, and then the rest are in the Palmer Talkeetna area. Okay. Yeah, there's nothing to see down there. One greenhouse is full of garlic. This greenhouse we're growing for the food truck. And the far greenhouse is all pumpkins and zucchini, but they're not growing anything yet.
So you say you're growing it for the food truck. You mean the food truck that's right outside the store?
Correct.
Wow.
Yes. As we start producing stuff, the more and more of the food coming out of the food truck is going to be grown from this ground here.
So you came from a farming family.
A family that dreamed of farming. Yeah. Yeah. Well, my dad homesteaded in Seward, but he lost the homestead. Then we ended up running a chicken farm for a guy that got it through some kind of a legal deal. And we built that chicken farm up from 1,500 chickens to 17,000 chickens. And then we moved over here to ranch cattle, but that didn't work out either.
How many people does the greenhouse employ?
Generally about 10 people. Off and on, I add teenagers in the spring and after they get out of school. And they're kept busy out in the fields mostly. So this big pile of peat, this is peat out of a muskeg. It gets hauled in February while the ground is still frozen, and so they can get their machinery out on the swamp without sinking out of sight, and then they haul this in. I typically get between 50 and 100 dump truck loads. This year it was 85 loads, and then the bottom started falling out, so that's as far as we got. That big pile over there is all topsoil that's salvaged from different clearing sites. Then I have to spread this peat out on the concrete here in thin layers and let the sun dry it, and then I move it inside.
Is that so that it won't mold in the bags?
No. Well, first of all, you can't mix this stuff with other materials unless it's dry. You can't mix it because it's just mud balls. So it has to be dry enough to mix. Second of all, who wants to stick their hand in a bunch of mud? It has to be dry enough to work with. Well, we bag it here, and then the palletized pallets go out there. And we generally do about 20 pallets a week.
I see that this is smoking. Why is it smoking right now?
Well, it's not smoking, it's steaming. Yeah, that's a hot floor. So that's another way of drying peat. I also use that floor for composting. So I compost fish and seaweed. That's the secret of fishy peat. I take fish meal. We used to use raw fish, but when you use raw fish, you got to compost it right away, which is in the summertime. It draws huge amounts of flies and maggots. And so we figured out if we use dried fish meal, we can store it. And then in the wintertime, when there's no flies, then we compost it on this hot floor. And so we take the seaweed off the beach, and then we take the fish meal, and we got our formula, and we put it all in here with peat, and it automatically heat up to about 140 degrees. And then I take this bobcat and I shove it outside, stir it up, put it back in a windrow inside. I keep it inside because you got to be able to control moisture, and especially late fall, we get an awful lot of rain, and that just kills a pile of compost. So we have to keep it out of the rain and out of the weather. But we stir it up out here, put it back in the windrow, and then that's the secret, because it's so full of microbes, it's so full of bacteria, fungus, those kinds of things that break down soil that feeds plants. It's so full of that, that's what makes Fishy Pete work.
Can we go somewhere where it's not so loud? So the floor is heated?
Yeah.
And that's with natural gas?
Yeah. There's a little tiny hot water heater there. It's running through pipes in the concrete. We take the raw peat. It gets ground up through this shredder. And then we mix our compost and lime. It goes through that blender. It's kind of like a big KitchenAid. Then up the conveyor belt into the bagger. That bagger is a timed machine where we just step on the pedal. He holds the bag and then watch him step on the pedal. And it's timed, so when the time runs out, it'll stop there. And he adds a little bit more just to make sure. Puts it on the belt, runs it through the sealer, and then they take it and put it on a stack. And out the door it goes. This is Alaska Earth. Alaska Earth is Fishy Pete mixed with ProMix. ProMix has a better drainage and it's got some really fine Canadian sphagnum moss in it, so it makes a nicer potting soil. We designed this soil for small pots because if you put Fishy Pete in it, Fishy Pete tends to compact and then it doesn't have as good a drainage as this stuff does. Fishy Pete is generally used by people that want to mix their own or use in large garden beds or raised beds, that kind of stuff, where they don't need that extra drainage. But in the smaller the pot, the more drainage you have to have so that it gets the air, roots get air, and then roots don't drown. We're the only ones that make potting soil locally out of native materials. So we're using native fish, we're using native seaweed, we're using peat, which we have eons of. And that was one of the ideas to begin with. My father wanted to utilize fish waste. He wanted to utilize all the seaweed that washed up on the beach. He always wanted to utilize this peat. And so he worked for years and developed this formula. I probably know a third of what he knows. All I do is follow his formula.
So the peat is harvested locally?
Yep.
What happens to the area once the peat is harvested?
Turns into a duck pond.
Is it on the property?
No, there's actually, we get a lot of peat when they're clearing off spots for gravel pits and stuff. Parts of those areas are peat. We take that. And then every once in a while, somebody wants a pond, and we go out and get the peat from there. There's a gazillion different types of peat, and I can only utilize one type. So we find a lot of peat all over the place, but a lot of it I can't use. So I can only use this one specific type. And don't ask me what it's called. I just call it horticultural grade peat. But there's lots of others. There's sedge peat and there's all kinds of other kinds of peat that's just not usable for potting soil.
So what does this particular type of peat add to the soil?
It doesn't add anything. It's just an organic base that holds the compost and the lime and the plants can stay in. Really no nutrient value at all.
So it's really just like a storage.
Yeah. Yeah, it maintains moisture for roots. It's a support for roots. It's a place where we can put nutrients in it for plants, all of that kind of stuff. But there's no mineral in it at all. What happens is when we add that compost, all those microbes in there will begin to break this down so that it can be plant usable. Plant can take it up.
So I was having trouble hearing you when you were describing before, but the compost you use is made from fish waste byproducts.
Correct. Primarily, I use white fish bone meal, which is made from cod and halibut bones, and then I use salmon meal. The same salmon meal is also used for fish hatcheries.
C- is this sort of like your bread and butter? Like, you're not dirt poor, you're dirt rich?
Yeah. I got a lot of dirt, but I don't know about rich. The dirt business kind of supports the rest of the operation. Without the dirt, I couldn't grow plants, at least in the large size six packs that I do, because I couldn't afford buying the soil, number one. And the revenue from the potting soil comes in earlier than the revenue from the rest of the place, which then pays the wages for everybody that's working here. And then by the end of the season, I've got everybody paid up, and the produce is my gravy, sort of my gravy. I don't pay myself a wage, so everything that we make goes back into the place. It's just a revolving door, really.
So you had said that, you know, you would learn this from your father. Do you have any children to pass on your skills to?
I have four kids, and they're all out trying to take over the world on their own, and they're not interested. It's too much work.
So I had heard that you started a natural resources program at the high school.
I started a lot of different programs at the high school.
Which high school are we talking about?
Homer High.
Well, could you tell us some of these programs? Are they mostly agricultural?
So I taught phys ed for 10 years. And then the guy that was running our ag program got fired, and they were going to cancel the program. And I made a big fuss about it because I had a lot of kids coming to my PE class all excited about all the ag stuff that they were learning. And so they said, well, we'll give you one class if you think you can handle it, and just shut up. So I ended up teaching an ag class. Eventually, I ended up doing all vocational stuff rather than PE. But we ran an FFA program out of there, and a lot of the Homer kids were taking national awards all across the United States.
So FFA is Future Farmers of America?
Correct. We had a first place team in floriculture in the United States. We had a first place ag mechanics team in the total U.S.
What is that, like working on tractors?
Ag mechanics is everything from surveying to calibrating big farm machinery to operating machinery to welding, fabrication, all of that kind of stuff. And I thought we had a really cool program, but what made me leave was they were going to cancel the whole program. And I said, I don't want to do anything else. I just want to keep this program. And they said, well, you don't have a choice. And so I quit and came out here and started helping my parents work this place. But there's so much potential for agriculture because it's one of the easiest things to become an entrepreneur at without a lot of investment.
Why do you say that?
If you want to be an independent entrepreneur, for most people, you can't go out and buy a $100,000 excavator or whatever and then really take these technical jobs right off the bat. But you can become a farmer, you can become a logger, a sawmiller, a carpenter, all of those kinds of things, all based off of agriculture. You can process food, you can do a lot of things without a huge investment. And that's a cool way for kids to learn how to deal with entrepreneurship and all that kind of stuff. But our school system just does not support any ag education. It's just weird.
You know, having taught ag education for years, what do you think about the current state of agriculture in Alaska?
We're back in the 19th century still.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it's a bad thing. I think any society is based off of agriculture. If you don't have an agricultural base, you have a boom and bust economy always. Agriculture is what stabilizes an economy. And look at Alaska. It's boom and bust, boom and bust, boom and bust. It's all because we don't have a large enough agricultural base to stabilize that. And so, how do you get more farms? How do you do that? Well, first of all, kids have to be exposed to the possibility that they could do this stuff, number one. I really wanted to see a really good, solid FFA ag program in all of our high schools, not just one, because agriculture, an agriculture class or a program doesn't preclude you from going to college. In fact, it makes you a better college prep student. A lot of people think, well, that's vocational agriculture. It doesn't prep you for college. BS. Problem is, our schools don't support it enough to give enough kids exposure to ag. That's the only way ag's going to be built here. That's how ag was built all across the United States. They had ag program, vocational ag programs with FFA. Those people are the ones that's running those 10,000 acre farms. Those are the people. We don't do that.
But I mean, really, is our 10,000 acre farms the solution
for
Alaska?
No, no, absolutely. Our climate and our topography doesn't work for that. The other part of the problem is we don't have processors. In the South 48, if you grow tomatoes or you grow barley or you grow oats, they've got a place to take it so that there's somebody there that's going to take it and process it. We don't have any processors in this state.
Because we kind of got cut off with the bobcat earlier, could you talk about why agriculture is important in Alaska?
Well, all societies are supported by agriculture. Obviously, people have to eat. People have to be clothed and all of that. All of that comes from agriculture. If our total existence was based on trying to eke out enough food for us to eat, then there's no time to build doors and windows. There's no time to build machinery. There's no time to explore medicine or space or anything else. So that's the base. Agriculture is the base. And if any society without an agricultural base always experiences boom and bust economic cycles.
And that was Al Poindexter, recorded on April 25th, 2022, at the Anchor Point Greenhouse in Anchor Point. Coming up next, we visit with Jean MacArthur. She has been growing plant starts for the Wagon Wheel for over four decades. We talked to her at her home in Fritz Creek, Alaska.
Well, my name is Jean MacArthur, and I've lived in Homer since 1970. And I live out at Fritz Creek area always. And we came and there was just forest, there's just spruce forest. My former husband and I cleared the area. And then after Barbara Walker and her former husband lived just down the road, and Barbara and Woody had the wagon wheel. And so somehow it started. We'll just grow you a few plants. And it just kind of got going from there. It wasn't really planned to go into business, really. And I started with growing herbs. I didn't know much about them. I knew parsley and whatnot, but I thought it would be a good thing. And people weren't buying herbs at the time. It was parsley, and that was it. And Barbara would tell me, oh, Mrs. So-and-so bought two of your parsley and an oregano. And
so you had said that your former husband and you started this in the 1970s.
Well, we just bought the land and just moved from Homer and built the house, cut the trees down, and we did get the lumber from Builder Supply, which would be what Spinard is today, and just built a small house, like a 16 by 20 house. And then we wanted to garden, and we had a very small greenhouse, the 8 by 12 out there, and had tomatoes and six tomatoes on each side. And then that's not big enough. So started with the 20 by 20 it was, or 30. And then when we started to grow a few plants for the wagon wheel, well, of course, that wasn't big enough. Over the years, I've just added on more.
How big is this greenhouse currently?
30 by 80. 30 by 80. And the one next door is 16 by 72. And they're both, you know, wood and with the trusses. And we had the openers where they opened automatically, the kind that's on the principle of when it's warm, the oil expands and the window opens. That doesn't work anymore. We took the ones out of the roof because when the trees were cut, then there was a wind we never had before. It would work under them and then rip them, and it flipped over anyway. The ventilation in here are the jet fans.
So do you handle all of the starts yourself? Do you have other people that help you?
Well, definitely. I have people like Linda's been with me for a few years. She comes maybe 3 to 4 days a week, depending. And then I had another lady for a number of years for 4 or 5 days a week. And then I've had the odd, well, I don't mean they were odd, but a friend that would come, or somebody that would come to help out with the transplanting. I used to deliver with some help, but now at the wagon wheel, Stephen's parents will come and pick up the big orders now in the last couple of years, because I used to deliver in boxes in the Subaru.
Were you born and raised in Alaska?
No, I was born in Canada. In Ontario, in a place called Brockville, Ontario. It's on the St. Lawrence River. I've lived in a few other places, but I came to United States in, what year was that, 1963.
Can you give us an idea of your age?
Well, do you want me to just tell you outright? I'm 81.
Have you ever thought about how many starts you actually produce a year?
You know, I'm asked that question, and I don't know. I've never added it up. Because over the years, it's changed a little bit, but because they fill every space, and then it rotates out. There was a time when we had all the coal frames would be full on the outside that no longer using, and then that, what we call the cabbage house, that 12 by 60 would be just chock full of the brassicas. Well, a long time ago, would even have, like, up off the ground, have, say, lobelia there for a week or two. They can take the shade, but they would be back up on the bench. So it's production, and I'm sorry I can't tell you a number, because the flats just, we just keep transplanting and try to grow enough, and because we never quite get it right. I mean, we're close on some things, I guess, but in some, not enough. Like, there's never enough nasturtiums.
Do you have an idea of the different varieties that you grow? I guess these numbers don't really matter, but would you say over 100 varieties?
Are you referring to both perennial and annuals? And
I'm just talking about everything that you
everything.
Grow.
Everything. Oh, I would think so.
So when do you actually start planting the seeds?
Well, I start some basil in February even, because it's so popular. And then a few what I call window tomatoes then as well. So that could be same red robin or tumbler or Lozano, which are, if you want some early ones, and a few of those would start. Even in a few in January. No, I'm not talking many of them. But just so that they're available for anybody that's enthused and would like to grow them in their window or under lights. And they're usually the earliest that I start, other than a cucumber that I grow in the window, but that doesn't count. And so then, mainly there's some perennials I might start in February, and the big sowing of seeds tends to be like March, early March.
Do you follow a routine when you are sowing the seeds? I mean, I know that each plant has different needs. Mm-hmm. I don't know, do you?
Try to time them, like time them.
Yeah.
I'm not that great at notes. But I do have a list, and then I will write down the list of plants that I'm going to grow. And then I will put the date down, and then the numbers will say, like, 1F would be like one flat. That would be one strip tray like this. Like the, all of, say, the pansies or the brassicas are not planted all at the same time. I'll space them maybe a week or two apart because they go to the store. So many will be going, you know, in May and some into June even. And then of course the cucumbers are started later, like I'm starting some now, and in various batches, you know, do, you know, maybe 15 or 20 of the different kinds. And so again, they germinate quite quickly in the heat.
So tell me about your light setup.
Well, I have shelves that are, ideally they would be 12 inches deep, but they're 18 inches deep. And they're 4 feet long. And then I have two light fixtures over each shelf. And I used to just have plain fluorescent lights because they're good enough from what I do. And then I got into LEDs that are a little more, they're more efficient because the electricity is very expensive. And I do have some grow lights that I've just started with them recently.
Are those the ones that are kind of a purple tint?
Kind of, yeah, the pink, kind of pink and purple. They're supposed to have the blue and the red, kind of all spectrum.
So you've been providing starts for the wagon wheel since the 1970s. What has changed throughout that time?
Well, of course, the volume has changed. And also earlier, the demands as earlier, because we never would have started, say, the brassicas until, say, at least the middle of April. And now it's at least a week or so earlier. It doesn't sound like much, but it is. People are, you know, planting, say, under remay or have different ways. And the high tunnels, it is definitely warmer.
So things changed in the 1970s.
It was the late 70s. It was really late 70s, probably. Maybe the first year might have been 77. It was small, you know, small. And those are the first few years when my former husband was also here. We would actually harden everything off. We used to carry everything out and back in to harden them off, teetering them on wood piles even, so that we had to harden them off. That was the thing, that they were sold and taken into the wagon wheel, completely hardened off. So 1982 was the first year that I was on my own to do the greenhouse, with help, of course. It was 1982.
So you've been doing it without your husband since 1982, 40 years.
And it's, of course, very seasonal. You order the seed in January, but lately it's been in the fall. Although the last couple of years with COVID, some of the seeds weren't available, but due to inefficient, you know, they couldn't get the seed, or they had difficulties even getting the seed, then having the labor to package the seeds. But we couldn't complain, though, because there were plenty of seeds.
Is this your main source of income?
Yes. Yeah, it is. Oh, I have taken odd job and different jobs. I used to help out in different places, but it is.
Were your jobs related to plants?
No, caregiving. I'd help out. And I used to help out at, well, that's a long time ago, at a print shop.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that was just collating. That's a long time ago when Fritz Creek Studios, and they were down, you know, at the dip of, at Fritz Creek, you know, as you go down into the dip. Well, that's changed because they had a home down there, and then they had developed a print shop in the early 70s. And they even printed the newspaper for a while, but it was on a page. The press wasn't big enough to print a big, full newspaper page, so they were done on, I forget the size, but they were printed and then collated, which I used to collate on this machine, and then you put a colored paper between each issue, and then you had to put it in a clamp and then glue it.
So collating is just gathering together.
Gathering. Mm-hmm. They were all in order, and they would come out, and so you'd take them. And yeah, it was interesting when you think about it, and how it would be the labor that was involved in it. I mean, it was just, then you had to take this knife, and you slit between, the colored page would note that the next issue was there. And then you saved the colored pages, and then you piled the papers up, and that was the Homer News. That was the Homer News.
So you were kind of like the hub of information during the 70s, it sounds like.
Well, no, I couldn't say that. I was not the hub of any of the information, but this was what my good neighbors did for a number of years, and I happened to be free to do it. So it was fun. It was fun to go down there.
What was Fritz Creek like back in those days?
Fritz Creek, well,
just the community of Fritz Creek.
Well, as far as this road went, we were the first one on the road. This was a homestead that belonged by the buyers, owned by the buyers, or homesteaded. There was Carly and Frances Pavlov, who was the sister, and Carl, who was kind of the patriarch, because it was two sisters and a brother, and then the son, Hilda's son, and they had homesteaded all butted up against each other. And then the general store, at the time, it was a community center where they would have dances, and that was a little before. They used to vote there. And then the homestead, was the Homestead Tavern, was the restaurant wasn't there when we came. And they'd have a jukebox, and they had polkas on it because the people were originally from Bavaria. So there were polkas, you know, people would dance and polka. And then at the bottom of the hill, where there was just Hilda, and then there was Carl, you know, the big house as you come off East Road. There's the big glass greenhouse. I don't know if you noticed that, but that was Carl's, and the house wasn't there at the time, but it would be like a warehouse. He was going to turn it into a house. So in this area, there really were just that. And then Frances lived over by the homestead. She had a small house in there.
Are any of these old timers still around?
No, they've passed on. I used to hear about the Fritz Creek bachelors, but I think some of them married, but they've passed on as well.
The Fritz Creek bachelors.
Some of them married. Yeah, one of them had been married before, but he was still a bachelor, but he met someone who came to town and he was swept off his feet, so he wasn't a bachelor anymore. I don't want to name names or anything.
Right. So I want to go back to seed starting.
Yes.
What are some of the issues that you've encountered throughout the years?
Well, as far as the greenhouse, maybe I meant it would be space. I mean, you're trying to grow so much in a limited space, even though it looks like a lot of space if you don't really know, but it isn't a lot of space at all. I haven't had much problem with insects. I mean, that was just a horror to me. I've had aphids one time a couple of years ago. I'd had a few aphids on basil, and then I realized how I got them because I had a kiwi plant, a hardy kiwi start that I put in the entryway. Oh, well, it'll stay there for the winter, and then, you know, insects are going to go where they will go. So I try to keep everything as clean as possible, starting with fresh soil and keeping the equipment as clean as possible. Things can happen anyway, and I don't really take in other plants. I don't do plugs.
What are plugs?
Oh, those are big trays that come with individual, like big trays, and they come with plants already started. There might be 200 plants in a small tray, or they're varying numbers. So you get they're very nice though. They're very nice. You small developed plants, and then you just poke them out and then put them in the packs.
So you say that you start everything from seed. Are there any seeds that some seeds you might have, they might be cold stratified, or they might have different conditions, like some you might have to nick or something, like to mimic a bird?
I haven't done a whole lot of that. I know like some say lupin or something like that. I haven't done it. Sometimes I would just soak them. And I used to, when I started pansies in the past, and I don't know if they've changed, I used to say to put them in the refrigerator to cool them down for a few days. But I don't do that anymore, and I have no problems with it at all. But there are plants, and I couldn't name you any right off, that they generally are perennials.
What perennials do you grow?
Well, I grow some like Erebus, and I don't do this every year, Erebus and Aubretia, now some primroses.
Those are flowers?
Those are flowers. Oh, yes, they're flowers. They're rock garden plants. Some Shasta daisies and painted daisies, and a few little columbine. I don't grow as many as I did at one time. Also, pasque flowers, you know, the pasque flowers that are, you know them. They're purple. Yeah, most of them are purple. There are some native ones, and there are some red ones, or reddish ones. Poppies, oriental poppies, and
Icelandic poppies.
I do Icelandic poppies and some annual poppies as well, like Lauren's grape. They're annual, but if you keep them picked back, they will bloom all summer. You know how poppies are, they have a flush of them and then they're gone, but these will grow all summer.
So how about your soil mixture? What is that?
That is a peat vermiculite mix. I buy them by the bag. They're like 2.8 cubic feet. And they have vermiculite and peat and a little wetting agent in them, and I think a very little bit of fertilizer. But I'm told because of the COVID that there was a difficulty with vermiculite. They weren't mining vermiculite, which is some in the U.S. and some in other countries. But anyway.
What is vermiculite?
Vermiculite is an expanded mica that's mined, and that creates some air spaces, plus it absorbs some water and fertilizer. And it's a good mix, because I've used it for years. If you ever wanted any extra space, you could always add perlite, which is, that is a volcanic,
little,
for vermiculite, the white pellets, yeah. That adds air space. It's in some of the mixes. And sometimes we'll add that in. I don't grow baskets anymore. I used to, but there's not enough space, and this greenhouse is already so dark anyway. And the fiberglass has yellowed greatly over the years, and it wasn't the correct fiberglass to begin with. And of course, with the interior, there's plastic on the interior to create a space, an air space for insulation.
How is this greenhouse heated?
Heating is our furnaces. I have a furnace in each greenhouse. It's called a modine, which is, they're meant for greenhouses or big areas. And it's 150,000 BTUs, and the other one is just 100,000. And it's oil. I used to grow with wood until 1996. I heated the greenhouses with wood, double barrel stoves. And one thing about growing with wood is that if the electricity goes out, you still have the wood and you can keep going.
Have you ever had any catastrophes where the electricity went out?
No. When I got the furnace, I said I would never go without a backup, because I did have another wood stove at the time, but I eventually did. It's a lot of work.
In this greenhouse alone, there's probably thousands of plants, thousands of starts, mm-hmm. several thousands. So do you sell all of these to the Wagon Wheel, or at the end of the season, do you keep some for yourself? Do you have your own garden?
I do have a garden, and I grow tomatoes for myself, and I give away tomatoes. I don't sell them or anything, real eating tomatoes. The greenhouses and cucumbers and things. I do that. I do have a garden. I grow what most other people, I mean, often a little bit late getting in the garden, but I grow the broccoli, the brassicas, and sometimes I'll get to carrots. But, just a regular garden. And then I also help with a friend. We do the Baycrest garden up there, the vegetable garden up there on the Baycrest lookout. So I save plants, and also Tracy and I, who do that garden. So just things rotate, everything rotates, and we try to grow a variety.
When is the last planting for the season?
I'll probably plant maybe first part of June, but keep up on the basil. I try to keep basil going for a while in the summer, and I know there's often requests that there are more flowers that can be purchased, because some customers will come in and even in July and want some, and they're not usually available. So probably the first part of June that I would. And on those peppers you saw, I think I started them in the biggest one, and they were starting to put on even little buds, and that was the middle of February. So they were probably about an eight-week plant. Roughly after 6 to 8 weeks, you'll find two with tomatoes that they'll start putting on their buds.
So I noticed you don't have any sort of drip system for watering. How long does it take to water everything?
Sometimes a while, because I use the hose. I mean, the barrels you see there are full of water. I have a well, and bring it in from that frost-free hydrant and fill the barrels. And then I have to take the hose all the way over to the other greenhouse and fill. I have a fish tote, a 250-gallon fish tote, and some barrels over there. And so I just walk, and I have a pump. I just have one of those little, was it Little Chief pumps, and water with a hose. It does take a while. Right now it isn't as demanding because the plants are very small, and but after a while, it does, yeah, it does take a while. When we transplant, we have those 2 5-gallon containers there, and we always, there's a pot over there with boiling water, and then heat the water up. Try to have it kind of lukewarm if possible. And I don't fertilize heavy. I'm kind of a light fertilizer. I just might have a third, even for the transplanting, maybe a third to a half of fertilizer. And I don't think they need all that much in the beginning, because especially if they just have their seed leaves, they've got the nutrition in the seed leaves anyway. But just fertilize very lightly. And then usually it's once the true leaves come on. Of course, they're all at different stages. But fertilize roughly once a week with maybe half strength, roughly half strength fertilizer.
What kind of fertilizer?
And I'll use a fish kelp is one. Then I'll use like 20, 10, 20. It's a commercial fertilizer, a liquid fertilizer.
Have you thought about training people to do this kind of work in the future?
I mean, I would help anybody, but it's not that, you know, but I haven't thought about it. Mm-hmm. Because when I'm done with this place, then it's done. You know, it's not like there's a business to sell or anything like that. This is, it's done.
Yes, but it'd be a big gap in the community, because so many things come from the wagon wheel, come from here.
Well, I'm sure there'll be somebody that steps into my growing, or times change, or, you know, there are others that come. There's a lot of people that are moving here, and yourself, you might take up doing it.
No, maybe not.
It's a different thing. It's a different thing. You know, it's a different thing, I guess. Mm-hmm. It is.
Well, I think it's really amazing to hear how you have done this throughout the years, and also, you know, heating with wood to heat the greenhouse. That seems, and doing it, it sounds like you, a lot of it you have done by yourself, mostly.
Yeah, but you know, I'd had friends that come, and I say my former husband was here for the first few years, and that's how we got set up. I wasn't really set up to do all this. It was just one of those things that happened. While the stove was going, I'd start in mid-March then, and then I would sleep out here until... It was easy to do, though. It doesn't sound good, but it was. I had a sleeping bag and a sponge, you know, something under it. And I set the clock, and I'd have the wood all ready because it was in here. And then about, at minimum, was every 3 hours, because you keep it going. You're not just keeping it on. You want heat, you know, because it had to heat the whole place. And it always worked. And the plants that I had here, they did just fine. I managed to keep it from freezing.
Is there anything else that you wanted to say?
Well, just growing plants is very satisfying, and to see the plants, to see the seeds germinate and see them grow, and then put them in the garden or your baskets or window boxes. I've enjoyed very much my window boxes, flowers, and it's just very satisfying, and harvesting the food from your garden and preserving.
And that was Jean MacArthur, recorded at her home in Fritz Creek, Alaska, on April 25th, 2022. Coming up next, Nicola Revelo has your rundown of events and opportunities in local agriculture.
Hi, I'm Nicole from Homer Soil and Water with this week's roundup of news and tidbits on local agriculture and wild habitat, too. First up, we'd like to introduce you to the newest members of the team at our local Homer Field Office of the USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS for short. They're who you contact to get started with NRCS programs like the High Tunnel Program, irrigation systems, and other programs that incentivize local growers and landowners to manage their lands in ways that protect our soils and ecosystems. The first is Emily McDonald, Emily worked as an organic vegetable farmer for 5 years in high school and college, and then took a hydrologic technician position for the U.S. Geological Survey working on FEMA flood mapping for a year. From there, she moved to South Dakota to work as a soil conservationist for NRCS, and now is our Homer Field Office soil conservationist, taking over for Pam Voller, who you've heard in past episodes of Homergrown. And our newest NRCSer is Katie Schmidt. Katie grew up right here in Homer, and after 5 years out in the Midwest and Oregon building up skills in soil conservation and ecosystem management of rangelands, wetlands, and forests, Katie has returned back home to work for our local NRCS field office. In college, Katie actually interned for us at Homer Soil and Water, and we're really happy to announce she's back in Homer working in the field she loves. Next up, and speaking of high tunnels, would you like to grow in a high tunnel but don't have one of your own? If you answered yes, then there's an opportunity for you. Local resident Jeff Thalman has a 20 by 32 foot high tunnel with about 400 square feet of planting area and is seeking someone to grow in it this year. Plant what you'd like. Jeff doesn't want or need part of the harvest. It's just too much for him to take on this season. Therefore, he'd like to extend this opportunity to another who would make use of the space to grow their own food. The property is in a quiet, peaceful area with a lake and located about halfway down the old Sterling Highway between Homer and Anchor Point. If you are interested, give Jeff a call at 907-235-6218. Here's a bit of good news for local foods enthusiasts. There's a brand new store in Soldotna that will be selling locally produced veggies, cottage foods, and all sorts of Alaskan-made items. It's called The Goods, and owner-operator Willow King and her crew have been working hard to renovate the building where the Caribou Family Restaurant once was, just as you enter Soldotna. They also have a huge commercial kitchen and will be serving up healthy foods using local ingredients when available from their deli counter. They're having a grand opening celebration on May 16th, so next time you're heading up to Soldotna, check out this new local foods business. And last, but not least, Homer Soil and Water Conservation District is hosting an in-person, hands-on gardening workshop on pest management secrets. Saturday, May 28th from 1 to 3 p.m. Come learn techniques for efficient management of common garden pests like slugs, root maggots, aphids, and weeds. There will be hands-on demonstrations of a variety of tools, such as row cover used for root maggots, hand weeding tools including the flame weeder, a tine weeding rake, a scuffle, and the collinear hoe, and also how to use a spray applicator for pest control substances. It's a great opportunity to see how these tools work in person, learn ways to effectively manage pests and encourage natural predators and healthy soil. The workshop will take place just east of Homer at the Walker Field, where we are conducting our cover crops field trials, 6.5 miles out East End Road, the first driveway east of the golf course. Joey Slovic of the UAF Cooperative Extension Service is coming down to Homer to help lead the workshop. All are welcome. Come on by and boost your gardening game.
And that's the show. I want to say thank you to Gene MacArthur and Al Poindexter for talking to us. Also, thanks to co-producer Nicole Arevalo and Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. Did you notice the new background music? You can thank local musician Kevin Cope for that. Questions, comments, or book recommendations can be directed to Desiree, that's D-E-S-I-R-E-E, at kbbi.org. I've been your host, Desiree Hagen, reminding you to support your local farmer. Thank you. Support for Homer Grown comes from Woda Botanicals, a retail store featuring tea, spices, herbal remedies, and books. Plant people focused on food, medicine, and discovery. In downtown Homer and on the web at wodabotanicals.com.